This is London Calling.
You are listening to Thought and Leaders.
Hello, 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 and welcome again to another global podcast that is Thought and Leaders. As you know, each week I scour this amazing, magnificent planet of ours for the most insightful, the most knowledgeable, the most controversial speakers out there, people with real stories. And this week is absolutely no exception. A huge privilege to have the very best in the business, this guy, Mark Bukowski. Hello, Mark.
Well, that's a hell of an introduction. Morning, Jonathan. We are in the morning, so you've scoured the world and you've come to me. You haven't looked very far.
For someone who's living in a remote cave in deepest Gloucestershire who may not have heard of you, do you want to give us a bit of a elevator pitch?
I flunked my university exams, discovered sex and drugs and rock and roll. I was a disciple of music, particularly punk, and Malcolm McLaren. And around about that time, my father died, which was a pretty cataclysmic event for a very young boy. And I had to grow up very quickly. And coming out of not working particularly hard to get into university, I decided that I'd better do some work and retake my exams and go on to that later. I ended up working in a bacon factory, can you believe it, selling hams. And I learned very quickly the art of telephone selling on one level, hated it. I was earning quite a lot of money then for a young lad. And then by hook and by crook, I ended up leaving that, probably got fired from it. I got a job miraculously. I can remember and think it was a worthless interview to go for because I had no chance of going to work into theatre. I had no background into it, and it seemed such a distant thing how much I loved theatre at the time of performing arts. But a man called Krishna Dandekar saw something in me and gave me a job. And from then on, it's been either upward or downward, whichever way you look at it.
The Wyvern Theatre?
The Wyvern Theatre in Swindon. I did a night with Spike Milligan once.
Really?
He was doing a night there, and I tried to persuade him to do some interviews. And he was hallucinating at the time. He had malaria, and he thought he was on a cruise ship, and I was a captain of the cruise ship.
Right.
But it was the most bizarre way of trying to barter with somebody to do some interviews with some journalists afterwards. And he said, look, I can do all these interviews and not do the show, or do the show and not do the interviews. Your choice. So I decided to obviously let the show go on. But he described Swindon as a remarkable place, the only place that he knew that they didn't bury their dead, they propped them up in bus shelters. I have a huge affection for Swindon because it was my first break. And from Swindon, I was getting lots of publicity, more than most theatres at the time. And a man called Paul Elliott, who's a producer still with us, said, you've got to come to London. You've got to work in London. And I went to see some folk. And then I ended up at the Theatre Royal Stratford East, where I met my next significant influence, a man called Philip Headley. Uh-huh. And I went freelance, and the rest is history.
You have worked with some amazing people, Three Tenors, Eddie Izzard, Amnesty, Selfridges, the Bolshoi Ballet, Sir Cliff Richard.
Listen, I've been doing this since I was 19, in truth. I never worked a day in my life, and I say that to my own kids, find your passion.
Right.
I've learned from major mistakes. I've actually learned more from mistakes I've made than the successes.
I get that.
I've been on a remarkable journey. I just get a buzz from my last job, really, and I'm lucky enough still to be employable.
You and I have a great interest in the history of propaganda, don't we?
If we all, as a human race, spent more time learning the lessons of history, we might be in a better place globally.
Mm.
Politicians from every hue in any country seem to be the worst people to run a country. and no more than what we've gone through at this current time. For me, looking back is a way of considering how we move forward.
It seems to me that people don't ever learn anything from history. It's just like it just comes around again.
No, we don't. We don't. There's some remarkable testimonies out there that we all should listen to, and we could easily create another Holocaust.
As serious as that?
If Trump and Brexit is an indication about how people feel passionately about something to the extent, I mean, you know, Trump is no longer in power, but, you know, look at how many people voted for this. We all live in our bubbles, greater now than ever before. If someone like Goebbels comes along tomorrow, which he can, and using the power of the internet, we could evenly stir up. I mean, humans lack a certain amount of ability to grasp the essence of critical opinion and common sense at the moment. We talk about fake news. We talk at the perpetrators of fake news. We talk about the platforms that allow fake news to proliferate, the likes of Facebook, Google, who know where the bad operators are, yet they're doing nothing about it and are not governed by the same rule as, say, the Washington Post or the Times or the Sun are. I mean, if the Times and the Sun allowed on their platform some of the stuff that is allowed on Facebook, they'd be shut down. But of course, you know, Facebook and the social channels, they don't face the same regulation as publishers. So that's very dangerous for me. It's all well and good Zuckerberg saying it's not the fault of Facebook, it is the problem of society. Well, Facebook is propagating that problem.
You and I have been involved with PR for quite a bit of time. You staged the first UK cowpat flinging competition.
Yeah.
You also did a thing where you released all these scorpions all over the place.
Two scorpions, to be exact.
But this is the thing, right? There were only two scorpions, but then it goes into legend and then it becomes like, you know, an army of scorpions. And the point I'm making is this, you're talking about fake news. Do you think that PR can influence to such a point that it can make something which is two scorpions, that people start thinking about armies of scorpions?
We talk about sort of authenticity and the narrative of the story. People will look at a story and actually, I mean, this is part of the problem we have at the moment, is that because of proliferation of so many channels, they feel emotionally connected to their own truth. So what is their truth is another man's lie. You talked about my history, and it's right. I did write two books. The first one was The History of the Publicity Stunt, and I wanted to explore whether or not a picture's worth 7,000 words.
An excellent book, yeah.
No. And when you start delving back into, and this is where my journey began, where I thought, of course, as a young sort of 23-year-old at the time, that therefore I was, you know, omnipresent. I was doing things that no one else had done. But of course, loads of people had done it before me and infinitely better, the likes of P.T. Barnum. And Jim Moran, who was one of the greatest publicists of his generation, took an idea to a brand and then sold the idea to the brand, and he would guarantee publicity at the end of it. The coined a phrase, which I used for many years, there is nothing more dismal than a fact. And he played with things in a mischievous sort of way. He wasn't involved with the dark arts. I mean, if you go back to the likes of Bernays or perhaps P.T. Barnum, they perhaps had a dark side to the way that they were manipulating the news to make a lot of money. In my day, I was working on many of those stunts, sometimes for commercial brands, a majority for entertainment things. It felt so much innocence involved with those sort of things. So if you think about a cowpat flinging challenge, it was done for Hank Wankford, you know, still going, a country western star. I had a huge show in the Edinburgh Festival. Edinburgh was a huge part of my life. I went every year.
Yeah.
And everybody was out there for a bit of fun. They didn't look too much into the detail. And it's true that we put an appeal out. We found a farmer who had a pile of cowpats. They came in, we had to dry them off, and it was like throwing a frisbee.
Yeah.
But I remember we had to use the dig we had rented in Edinburgh, and we had to use a microwave to drive off the cowpats to make them flexible enough. At the end of it, it cost me a brand new microwave at the time, and they were more expensive then. So I think I lost a lot of money on that press stunt, but we generated a lot of publicity, and it was a huge amount of fun. We're selling stories now, so there's a lot more critical opinion of your work. And everybody now has a vehicle, Twitter or whatever social channel, to tell you what they think of you.
Yeah.
Which at the time your ego wasn't popped so easily.
You're saying that there's no such thing as dangerous as a fact.
Dismal, Jonathan. Dismal, not dangerous. Dismal. We've changed already, you see. We've changed the suit.
Well, talk about manipulating lies. Think about Joseph Goebbels. Now, he said, if you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. You know, the whole of this COVID communication has been a repetition of complete confusion. Take the story of the Brazilian variant. In one news report, I heard them say it was called a variant of concern. And then in the same news report, Johnson said it was a variant of no concern at all. Huh.
We no longer trust the media in the old ways that we would have broadsheet publications or tabloid publications, the BBC, a limited amount of choice in terms of where we received our information. And there was possibly the investment in news that existed. Now the investment is in clickbait. There is money in this type of fake news, and this is why it's accelerated. Before, we would look at, you know, August publications like The Times, The Telegraph, The Guardian, and if they set the agenda, we would look at it. Now it's this sort of splintered into a thousand shards of light that shines opinion on a particular story. And the biggest challenge that we have going forward, and this is my personal passion, slightly coming from the person who played with fake stories, that's for sure, there was a greater sense of critical knowledge. So therefore, if we do not actually teach kids coming through critical opinion and an ability to judge stories, look through the lens of fact, then we're a losing battle. It all stems from education. And great education. If that is debilitated and that those who want to manipulate, then they're going to have a field day. The majority of the work that my agency does now is predominantly oriented around crisis, helping people get through situations that they find themselves through a rogue tweet or, you know, getting sucked into cancel culture or having to deal with an enemy that wants to bring them down. And I see how stories are seeded. And there's lots of ways that architects of your own downfall can seed your stories years in advance and see those stories pick up. And the amount of techniques that go into developing a counter narrative against you is deeply depressing. That someone overnight can find something that has been seeded on the internet that is picked up. If we think of the parish council story and infamous now Jackie Weaver, I mean, that's 8 months old. That meeting is 8 or 9 months old.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, it can click in. I mean, certainly it was in the summer, 6 months. It certainly wasn't last week.
Really? So what would have happened there, Mark? How come now?
Well, one news source, whether it's true or not, I place that to health warning on what I'm about to say, suggested that it was found by some hipster who loved going into these meetings that were all online and liked to go and look at these meetings because he'd like to see, unquote, old people struggle with Zoom, and found this extraordinary meeting and then shared it with his mate. Bingo, it just has a tipping point.
Is it that the media, they're looking for who's got the biggest splash in order to make the splash in the news? For example, you did an amazing thing. You arranged for a question writer to do with Trivial Pursuit to walk an elephant into a betting shop to promote, as I said, Trivial Pursuit. You're the master of getting people's attention.
Yeah, of course it's about getting attention. It's about getting people talking. It's about how do you inject the sort of virality into word of mouth. I mean, I learned that from Pinky Barnum.
You were talking about clickbait. Shock headline after shock headline after shock picture after shock this. People are becoming a bit blasé to it.
The one thing I write in the top of my to-do list every day, and I do physically write those things every day, I always include, you know, sort of an aphorism that I believe, which is everything is different, everything is the same. The visceral things that the human looks for and is stimulated is no different from how the caveman was stimulated. For males, it's feeding and fighting and what's the other F? You know, I think there was a book called The Ape Complex by Dr. Steve Peters, which talked about these things that motivate our primeval self. And I think the medium of the day. Every great publicist of every generation has used the medium of the day. So whether it's live performance, whether it was the telegraph, whether it was movies, typewriter, whether it was the sort of fax machine, we wanted to use technology to speed our message because we want people talking with us. And nothing has changed. Now there is a huge opportunity to create noise. You just have to get your cultural references right. Look at the sea change that we have now in a much more aware world where people are much open about talking about their mental health. Thank God there's a greater sort of freedom in terms of sexuality and gender. We're still going through the foothills of understanding that. There's different touch points one can actually use to ignite the crowd, but it comes back to you and me hearing about something and talking about it. Is generating that conversation. And that is the heart of the art of the publicist to do that.
Now, I know that you have greatly admired the German Chancellor for how she has handled getting the COVID message across to her nation.
I think that the difference between Merkel and Johnson was that, Merkel didn't make it political.
Yeah.
She saw this as a health issue and it was communicating health messages. Basic problem for our current administration is they've made this political. Yeah. They've got one eye on maintaining power and they've got the omnipresent sort of necessity of navigating what Brexit looks like over the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And also Merkel is a statesman. I don't believe Boris Johnson is a statesman. He's more of a stand-up comedian. He wants to be liked by everybody. If you look at the constant mistakes his government going is for the not just the sort of the front end of the machine, the Gavin Williamsons on education, the Matt Hancocks, the Oliver Durdens, but also all the people that run around after them. We've seen many stories about gerrymandering and in terms of people on contracts and who got this and who's got their hand in the till or whatever. I mean, it's a very confusing message, but they seem to be getting the vax program right. And I think that's probably aided by the army and logistics and whatever, according to Boris, but they are getting that right. And do you know what? We're beginning to forget the mistakes that were made initially because we want to get out of this. And if someone can pull us out of this, and if it is Boris, it is vax, and the propaganda that's possibly because of Brexit, we're buying into those sort of stories.
So what would you have done?
I would have been tougher sooner. You've got to dish out the medicine quickly. And things like the Atletico game in Liverpool should have been cancelled. Cheltenham Festival, Racing Festival should have been cancelled. We should have done things sooner. And, to vax or not to vax, to mask or not to mask, it is about leadership. Rory Sutherland said that the communication and that was evident in the first part of the pandemic, if that had been the way that we were tackled the Germans in the Second World War, the Nazis would have been walking down Whitehall within weeks.
Mm. You noted in one of your blogs, and I thought, yeah, he's right. It's a very small, and people would say almost silly detail, Boris's haircut. And you were saying, why can't he get a haircut? It is important from a PR image perspective, isn't it?
His hair has always been, people have said that without having no hair, you don't get any authority in politics.
Be careful, Mark. You've got no hair.
I know. I'm talking to a man who, perhaps doesn't visit the barber as often as I do. But although I haven't been to the barber now for a year and you don't want to look at my health. Thank God this is a podcast. I've got to be careful what I preach, but there's something about his demeanor and the cut of his cloth. And he always looks like he's been, as my mother would have said, dragged through a hedge backwards. But he has his own unique style that actually worked for him as London mayor.
Yeah.
He had better people around him then, in my estimation. But somehow it doesn't do it for me. But look, his popularity stakes are rising.
But that's because of the vaccine, though, isn't it?
Correct. The mistakes made in politics take years to find their way to the top. Some of the mistakes made in the 50s, were inherited back in the 70s and the 80s. Post-war generation, men being given jobs that they weren't suited for, running huge nationalized industries, old boys network, which was horrendous. Yeah. We're not going to see the ends of the effects of COVID for generations. Yeah. That's a sad thing. There was an old line about I think it was a Chinese diplomat was in some sort of do, was asked a question of what was the effect of the French Revolution. And the Chinese diplomat turned around and said, it's too early to tell.
Ha, so insightful.
Look them in the eyes and tell them you're doing all you can to stop the spread of COVID-19. Stay home, protect the NHS, save lives.
One of the things that has happened during COVID, and it's been like watching them try to fine-tune it, Mark, the government sloganizing. They've tried to get it right, and then that didn't quite work, and then they tried something else. And, you know, my background is also partly in advertising, so I understand slogans. But, you know, please, I'm getting confused.
We all strive for the power of three. Say no more than three and make those three things incredibly powerful. The original slogan about protecting the NHS was very strong. But, you know, we get fed so many marketing messages every day. We're immune to it. I think Mullen Lowe, who were originally the advisors to the government, didn't do a bad job. As this thing shaped and morphed and we got different variants and figures went up and went down. I thought for me, it was the sense was when people were getting very blasé about the pandemic in the autumn. But the logical test is, when does the flu season hit us? The flu season hits us through January, the dark days of February and March, and that's really turbocharged by Christmas when all the bugs get sort of thrown around in homes. And that's when I always seem to get a bug. And I said to everybody, we're not going to see the true effect of this until March or April. And yet we should have been tougher about Christmas. I'm sorry, we should have been.
But he didn't want to be the Grinch that stole Christmas.
Correct, because it was politicizing. He was thinking as a political figure, not as a health figure, blinded by science, admittedly. The downturn came with the famous Barnard Castle, Dominic Cummings trip, where everyday people were looking at that and said, look, it's one rule for us, another rule for them.
But in PR, in the history of PR, don't we always need the scapegoat?
Most brands, most people in politics now and people trying to navigate a crisis hope on short-term amnesia and long-term memory loss of the crowd. One crisis is forgotten about in weeks.
I've been involved with big brands where someone somewhere said something or got involved with this and that, whatever it might be. And one of the things that my colleagues used to say in certain circumstances, Mark, not in every circumstance, was say nothing. Now, the government tried that with COVID, especially famously in the United Kingdom with a morning television show, Good Morning Britain, where they wouldn't even come on to speak to the journalists. So this idea of say nothing, does it still work even today?
Every crisis brings its own challenges and its own dimension. I don't think there's any solid, hard, fast, single rules that run things now. When you could say nothing at the time, there wasn't the sort of explosion of social channels that gave people an ability to have an opinion. And, you know, sometimes there is enormous legal ramifications that anything that is said that can create a mass class action in the future. You have to look at each situation and think about how it's come. The only thing that remains the same is that your behavior and your attitude as a leader has to be consistent. And you have to invest in relationships over a period of time. And you have to be transparent about it. And I think there's a greater need now, particularly in FTSE 100 companies. You have to be a communicator. You have to be media savvy. And I've seen some great people navigate out of really difficult waters because they've put the hours in on building a relationship with the very media that they have to turn to in a crisis.
Yeah, Richard Branson's famous for that.
Well, he was, yes, definitely. But you can see who the man is. It's now about authenticity. A lot of leaders struggle with communicating on the level which is necessary in a social world. Listen, someone who's at the top of a tree running a company in these days have got there because of his or her or their ability. Yeah. In the old days, it's who they knew through their circuit. So therefore, if they're challenged by something where something's gone wrong, they need to know the structure of their business has the early warnings to deal with that. But we all are hit by the black swan. And that's a scary bit.
Yeah, no one ever expects to see the black swan. It suddenly appears. One of the things that people talk about with COVID and authenticity and leadership is people often say to me, I wish this guy on TV would just say, look, we got it wrong. Mia Kalpa, I got it wrong. But you have said in one of your blogs, look, stop apologizing and start leading. What you're saying, don't apologize?
People want someone to say, mia culpa, it's me. And that it actually sometimes is absolutely 150% the best route to take. There are some complexities where you, perhaps you don't know the facts in front of you. You don't know what's gone wrong. And they're expecting quick to effect action. But I always think the best way is to face up and actually look down at the camera, if you've got that ability to communicate that, and let people see what you are saying and be empathetic, look at what is done and where possible do it. I mean, one of the greatest challenges that I think that I've faced is to see how at the end of the recession, banks like Lloyds dealt with crushing SMEs. Their sins are extraordinary. There is a way that they could have dealt with that quickly.
What should they have done?
The famous Reading scandal, where a group of people based out of Lloyds were closing down businesses. That is still trundling on.
Yeah.
When the full extent of Dobson and Co. was exposed, and whistleblowers had, and reports like the Marston report had been thrown up, instead of turning to lawyers and paying vast fees to lawyers to obfuscate, they should have cleared up and settled with many of these people who they'd actually ripped off. The money that they've spent on advisors and lawyers and could have cleared this whole mess up. Sadly, some people have taken their lives because of this.
A couple of more questions, Mark. I know you're busy. You're talking about the idea of looking down the camera, seeing the person for who he or she really is, one of us kind of thing. What do you think about the performance of Hancock when he looked down the camera and he started to cry, but there wasn't any tears?
His face doesn't represent what his brain is telling him to do. That's a problem. Look, Matt Hancock is manhandling, you know, a very, very difficult situation. We all can see that at some point that the man has done his absolute best. He did what he could at the time he could. History will judge each of those people and what they've done. I mean, I certainly wouldn't want Matt Hancock's job, and I certainly wouldn't Boris's job. So it's very good, you know, for me to sort of, you know, make barb satirical remarks about these things. There comes a point in everybody's work, we've got to look at it and say, can I take this job on any further? And sometimes your answer is no. And that is then to retire and actually bring the next person in and bring fresh eyes to look at the situation. That should have been done. And I mean, track and trace, which we don't talk about now, was a debacle. And I think we will see stories coming out of this complete experiment anybody in tech was telling people would not work. There were answers there. We have people, and we have organizations that could have taken this, and they just didn't fulfill the procurement levels. We talk about this being a war situation, and yet we did no requisitioning. And we look at PPE, and we look, all those sort of things aren't going to go away for these people. So they're desperately trying to fix it. It's a bit like, you know, when you're faced with a lot of negativity on Google, you're trying to fill Google up with better coverage, better thought leadership to push this stuff down. And I think this is what we're seeing here. They're hoping they're going to come up with the silver bullet that's going to rescue everybody. We're all going to be on our massive summer holidays, enjoying things and drinking in bars again. The theatre is going to be open. Live acts are going on.
Oh, yeah.
You have to deliver that sort of news. And that's what Churchill was very good at in wartime, delivering bad news.
We are slowly but surely coming out of this. At some point, Mark, you're going to be at various boardrooms advising people on what to do with their PR and their crisis management. And also there's going to be these marketing people and all the rest of it. Another article that you wrote about Pfizer, these people were able to turn around the vaccine in miraculous time. And yet it took over 18 months for them to change their logo because they had to keep on talking to consultants and PR people and marketing people. Do you think that the days of dragging it out and people taking so long, it's all going to change because COVID has taught us some lessons?
When we finally get out of this, there's going to be one hell of a upshot. The good thing about COVID is we've now looked at the small things that are important, and we should cherish those things, you know, family, friends, coffees. It's the tiny things that we didn't focus on. At last, we're focusing on the important people in life, no less than the NHS. And if it's going to get a revamp, you know, great news. I still think it's appalling that Sir Tom actually had to turn funding into the NHS into a telethon. It should have been funded from the start.
I found the whole thing with this great man, Sir Tom, slightly uncomfortable. And it worries me from a PR point of view. I'm sure they'll have a million statues of him surrounded by the NHS or whatever it might be. But it does bother me, going back to you and my interest in the history of propaganda and stuff like that, about, you know, what they're going to turn this great man into.
I think they mustn't trash his legacy and they mustn't hijack it. But if they're diligent enough to keep an eye on the growth of the myth, because things do become mythologized, you talked about that earlier on. As always, at this time, the people who have suffered the most are the poor and underprivileged. All well and good for me sitting in a nice home in Gloucestershire, being able to have the luxury of talking to you and having a company that's been operating fairly successfully through this time. And I thank my lucky stars every day.
Of course.
But I can't think of how it is for the poorest people in our society who are absolutely, you know, on the breadline and going to soup kitchens.
So true.
I mean, it's shocking that we would ever get to that. We need to come back to this touchy-feely time that we'll go back into, take ourselves out of this impersonal contact of Zoom and get back to looking at the things that made our life wonderful. I saw somebody yesterday talk about a rich man might crave millions of things, but someone who is ill craves only one thing, good health. That's what we've come back to. All that matters is your health and your family and stability.
Absolutely. To count your blessings, Mark, to count your blessings. Now, you are, as I said at the start of our chat today, one of the most notable people in PR and now also in crisis management. If people want to get hold of you, how do they do that?
They can go to a website and there's plenty of ways to contact me. You know, it's all there in borkowski.co.uk, or you Google my name. There's plenty of ways to come to my door.
Fantastic. So I urge people, if you really are seeking the very best in the business, he knows his stuff because he understands it, not just from a practical point of view, but he understands the science of all of this stuff. Then he is the man for you to contact. So until we speak next time, Mark, take care, count your blessings, and thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much for the kind words you've said. And Jonathan, it's always a joy talking to you. And may your podcast multiply, because it's a lovely thing just to take, you know, sort of an hour out and have a chat, which we don't do enough of.
That's so true. So true. So true. So until next time, everyone, you know how to contact him. And I'll be speaking to you very soon.
Thought and Leaders is a Goodbye production. If you're looking for award-winning content for your brand or want to chat about the show, you can either email reinvent@me.com, that's reinvent@me.com, or why not visit us at www.thoughtandleaders.com. That's thoughtandleaders.com.